You can't replace part of the brain. Like, you
treat them the same.
The source of truth for the medtech industry.
Coexists with the
robot. Robot understands things automatically.
Number one show in the medtech industry.
So Stryker got ahead of that and changed it. In the 90s, built $1 billion company that helped up high. A lot of things.
State of medtech.
With your host, Omar M. Khatib.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Really interesting episode, as this is kind of a reunion episode with an old friend of mine and colleague, and that's Mr. Yossi Bar, who's the founder and CEO of LEM Surgical. That's spelled L-E-M. You can learn more about them at lemsurgical.com. So Yossi and I met first when I started my career at Mazor Robotics, which is the world's first robotic spine company. He was the director of R&D there. I was a sales rep, and at some point, I became the U.S. marketing manager. And so we worked side by side, sort of in the trenches, pioneering robotic spine surgery. And of course, you know, over 12 years ago, it was a tough fight. But now robotic spine surgery has become a new standard in spine surgery. We see multiple spine surgery robots. But the problem is that a lot of these robotic spine companies we see today have made just incremental improvements on the procedure. And so LEM Surgical kind of came as a result of this, in the sense that it was time to sort of bring forth a new revolution, sort of the next level when it comes to spine surgery. And this was kind of the conversation that Yossi and I had, because when I saw that he founded and became the CEO of this company, I asked him, I said, Yossi, why does the world need another robotic spine company? And his answer was so interesting that I said I had to have him on the show. Now, LEM has been in stealth mode, and understandably so, for some time now. And they're going to start coming out with more. You can go to their website to get a glimpse of the system. And so in this conversation, we kind of talk about the state of spine surgery, what LEM is focused on accomplishing, and more. It's a very interesting company, an exciting one, based in Bern, Switzerland, a very, very beautiful location. So, of course, for those of you who are looking for an exciting company to join, aside from the fact that Yossi's there, some fantastic leaders from Mazor Robotics have also joined there. So it's an exciting company. I'm really looking forward to following them along. And so in this episode, we cover all that and more. Now, that being said, if you're a startup founder and you're looking for help to get commercial traction, maybe you just raised some money and you're having a hard time finding early adopters, I want you to reach out to me. My company, Khatib & Co., set up digital sales strategies and marketing channels for you so that we can target, find, and nurture those early adopter physicians so that they can adopt your product and, more importantly, get into your pipeline and start using your product. One, because that's going to help your product team improve on the product, but more importantly, it's going to get you some commercial traction, which is a key point when it comes to raising money. You want to learn more about that, go to khatibandco.com and, you know, book a time to learn more with me, or just reach out to me on LinkedIn. And finally, when it comes to finding early adopters, databases are an important part of what I use, because you have to look at more than just publications. You got to look at procedure volume, prescription behaviors, what financial relationships does a physician have with what companies, right? All that and more. The problem with a lot of these databases on commercial intelligence is that they're really clunky. They're tough to use. You can't just adopt one and start using it with a sales rep. You know, even me as a marketer, I've struggled with some of them. That's one problem. The other problem is that they're really expensive. This is where Alpha Sophia has become a really key partner in my business and for my clients. And this is why I recommend them. Alpha Sophia is a sales intelligence platform that brings in all this great data on physicians. They just added a whole bunch of commercial data, commercial payer data as well, where I'm able to look up a surgeon, for example, and I only see their procedure volume, financial relationships, et cetera, their societies, publications, but I also have their contact information and their social media. And as you know, I'm a big believer on using network effects to drive adoption through social media. They have all that and more. I love the platform. And again, it's very affordable. Their base package starts at $300 a month. And, you know, at that point, anybody could afford them. So if you want to learn more and get not only one, but three free search reports through Alpha Sophia, go to alphasophia.com. That's alphasophia.com/Omar. That's going to get you three free reports, and you be the judge on how good that data is. So with that being said, let's get on to our episode with Yossi Bar, founder and CEO of LEM Surgical. Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. And so happy to have my guest on today.
Our guest today has actually known me from the very beginning of my medical device career, because when I left medical school, it was very hard to get into med device, but one company saw my potential and made that bet, and it worked out pretty well. And that was Mazor Robotics. And I'm joined by Yossi Bar, who is now the founder and CEO of a new surgical robotics company called LEM Surgical, who's been in stealth mode, but is going to be coming out of stealth mode soon. Yossi, it's so good to see you, my friend. How are you doing?
Good. Same here. Pleasure, Omar.
Oh, fantastic.
See you again and seeing you.
Absolutely. And I'm glad to see you're bringing the gang back together. You've recruited some really talented people over to LEM. And, you know, I'll tell you, you know, if you guys need any contract work or something, let me know. As long as I get an invite to Switzerland to go on your guys' ski trips, that would be nice.
only strangers need the invitation.
Oh, brother, I appreciate it. So, Yossi, before we talk about LEM, you know, we had a really good conversation about the state of surgical robotics and spine before. And I'm wondering if you don't mind kind of giving kind of your thoughts on it. I have my own thoughts about it. You know, when we started out in Mazor, we really pioneered robotic spine surgery. Back then, it was really just Mazor. And then after a few years, we ended up with MedTech Rosa, who got acquired by Zimmer, then Globus. Now, I don't know, there's like more robotic spine companies than I can count. But I'm wondering, what's your take on those companies as a whole in terms of the industry, and why does the world need a new robotic spine company?
And let's see where we start. First, of course, we need to do this basic differentiation just to be sure that it's clear for everybody. Not sure who are your listeners. But it's clear that we need to distinguish between two, let's say, families of robotic systems. Is that first, there is the big family, the big brother of the, let's call it the remote manipulators, the Da Vinci of the world, which of course is considered as the leading surgical robot, but this is another family. It's remote manipulators. Surgeon is sitting at a console, sitting, standing, doesn't matter, with a console, and they're basically, as it's called, remote manipulator. The surgeon is the controller. He sees everything, of course, enhanced visualization, et cetera, but he sees everything, and the surgeon is the controller. He decides what to do, where to cut, what to do, and 100% control of the surgeon. One family. We are in the area of, if we generalize it, we can call it the hard tissue robots, where the spine is one application. Here we are, and also here, it's a big family. You can even find there the old Renaissance spinosis, small robot. But the idea here that and what the hard tissue, the bone surgery requires, and inside also you can put the brain surgery, et cetera, is that most of the time the surgeon wants to do an action, wants to do something, and then he plan it on this or that modality, and he says, I would like to do this. So you need to have the ability to tell the robot, go there, do this. And where is there, and where am I now, and where I need to go. So you need a certain level of system. The robot, the controller, need to know where he is, what's his relation to the patient, and then where is there and how do I get there. So you send it, and they need to go independently, drive independently, reach the place and tell you, I'm there. This, it requires different kind of robotics. This is what we're doing. And in there, again, like you said, the many players, it's not like it used to be 15 years ago that you actually needed to build your robot. Today, it's a bit different. But still, in this family, you will not find many active players in spine. There are still the good old guys, the Mazor, Medtronic, and Globus Excelsius. They're a star, of course, good, intelligent people, good companies, but they're not very commercially active. For example, now a big player, Stryker, said that they're going to go in with their Mako system, at least from what I read from publications. So, and they're good and successful player, but not like in the soft tissue or in the remote manipulator. There you have, I don't know, over 100 players. So with everything that went and has been done in the last 20 years, still commercially available, you would not find many players. especially in spine. The bar is high, entry level is, and it requires, and it's not only a matter of accuracy, not easy to operate in spine.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You know, the thing about robotic spine surgery that I feel right now is that, you know, it's been around for over a decade, and it feels like it's still, you know, iterations on the same part of the procedure, which is pedicle screw fixation and placement, which is fine. But there's just so much more to the procedure that I think is needed, and I think maybe that do you feel like that's maybe one of the reasons why robotic spine platforms haven't been as widely adopted as they should be? Because for a lot of surgeons, like, well, I don't really need this.
Yeah, and of course, and but I need to see, and there are few ways to look at it. And let's start from the difficult part that you mentioned, that pedicle screws. And but so before we say what you do after pedicle screws, but even there, which is 20, 30 minutes from a 3 or 4 hour surgery, depends. And this is part of the thing, how many types of spine surgery? No, there's no one type of spine surgery. But let's say even there, and this is what I think Mazzola was the pioneer, one of the first pioneers to really put the role for robots to assist in pedicle screw placement. But even if you control only this portion of the surgery, and you see today, and it became almost standard of care, when you have over 1 million, you will know better than me the exact number, but 1.2 million surgeries a year only in the US, these are large numbers. And even if you, what is can be considered as an incremental support or incremental improvement, and you improve the accuracy by 2 to 3%. And in these large numbers, thousands of patients that you provided better health care. So just doing this, it's something that I would not underestimate. But of course, you're 100% correct. It's not enough. And basically, this led to this stagnation that you're talking about, and everybody are aware of it, that, okay, you show them the... Of course, like we discussed, Medtronic there, Mazzola Medtronic are not the only one. Globus are doing a very good job, and I'm sure that Stryker also do a good job. It was a good and significant beachhead, but for a hefty device, have a significant cost. And naturally, users are asking today, or surgeon asking today, or health provider asking, what's next? It's a 4 hour case. You help me with the first significant part. Great. What about interbody? What about decompression, osteotomy? How can you help me more so to justify for me to really embrace this technology? And it's a valid question. And there is still a lot to do there.
When you know, for you, you know, when we were at Mazzola, like at the early days, like it was very, very difficult, right? Very, very difficult. And you know, the story, yeah. And I remember there's plenty of times, you know, whether it's in Israel or over in Celebration, Florida, just in the labs, long nights, you know, a lot of hard hours and everything. When you left and you had some time off and everything, what kind of inspired you to, you know, because considering your background as an engineer, you could have gone into a lot of different areas. What kind of inspired you to stay in spine and say that there's still work to do and so there's still a lot of innovation to be done?
First, just to be accurate, I'm not an engineer. I've been doing this for many years, but and I'm really sorry for the cliche, but I am what you can call a dropout. I studied engineering and I have a solid engineering background, but I quit engineering to study philosophy, to the resentment of my father.
Yeah, but it made for a lot of great conversations between you and I over the years. So that's probably why we get along so well.
Yeah. So this is just to put things clear. All of the engineers that I worked with them all the years, they are always better engineers than I am. Good start. So I left Mazor 2016, pretty much right after Medtronic came in. And then I spent almost 5 years with another Israeli robotic company, not spine and not surgery. But the bug was there, always saying what can be done. And you challenge yourself, because exactly like you said, we did so much. I think we influenced, we did a lot. But exactly like you said, there was this feeling that it's not enough. Okay, you came to the beachhead, did some impact, but it's not enough. And as a matter of fact, you know, even if you look now, the crown jewel, the Mazor X, even under the hands of Medtronic, it's not reaching the magnitude of intermediate surgery. It's and the market is huge, the potential is huge, but exactly like you said, it's still not there. So apparently, there's still much to do, right? And this is the challenge. What was done? What, when you say it's not enough? Okay, what else is needed? And then how to do it? And then, at least from my experience, I saw along the years, and I'm not the first one saying this, that a good idea is not enough. And so sometimes you have a good idea, but to actually be able to fulfill this idea, make it happen, and even, God forbid, put it in the market as a product, there is a huge difference there. And then what triggers basically me getting back to spine, I was almost 5 years outside of spine. And I met you, and this is the reason we start, like always, like you always do, started immediately with the tough questions, but we didn't speak where I am today and what I'm doing today. But today I'm a company, Lamp Surgical. We are based in Bern, Switzerland. And this is what brought me to Switzerland 3 years ago. It was my partners, my founders with me. They are Swiss people, and I got to meet them. Extremely intelligent and nice people. And we started talking, and you can say they started talking. Okay, and they are all professionals, medtech professionals from different areas, and started talking. Exactly like you said, okay. Zoro was nice. What's next? What else can be done? And then we discussed. I said, okay, I have an idea. I know what I would do, but again, surgical robotic, it's more than a good idea. And then we got to meet each other, and I saw that they are extremely serious people. And then some of them decided to fund it themselves. And say, okay, good partners, solid funding. And they told me, if we do it, let's do it here in Switzerland. Why not? It's a good idea. And cut long story short, 3 years ago, founded LEM here in Bern, Switzerland. And ever since we're running. So the bug was there, but when the turns came together into actually making it feasible and giving it good chances to actually succeed, this was the cue to actually do it.
Got it. Now, I want to ask you, like, what is LEM? LEM, that's the name of the company. What does that stand for?
Yeah, LEM is from Stanislav Lem. He's a novelist. He wrote several novels. Some of them are known, some less. A lot about science fiction and time travel, a futuristic novel solution. And we thought it's a good name. So LEM, not any.
Got it. And, to date, at least from what I've seen on your website, you guys have raised a little over like $30 million. And, what I found to be very interesting is that you raised that money in, very tough market, very difficult times, because you did it
between, I think, 2020 and 2023, right? Very tough times to raise money. But you went about it in a very interesting way. You had, some private families and wealthy individuals and investors. Any advice to some of the founders who are listening to the episode now? Because a lot of founders are trying to raise money, and I'm wondering, in your journey in raising money, if you had any insights or any advice that you can impart on them, aside from just keep pitching.
We have this Israeli joke that only Israelis will understand when you say that you have to start in your maximum and then accelerate gradually. It's few things, and of course, I don't know if I'm in the position to give advice, or I would just spare my advice from my experience, not saying that this is the right thing to do. I don't know if there's one right thing to do. First, I think the one of the most important thing, this is what I started before, is to have good partners that can really help you, not only in the technology side, but also in the funding phase. For example, the beginning is always the first year. Everybody who did it one time knows the first year is terribly beautiful. It's great, but it's so difficult. And in the beginning, this is the point that you need the most help. For example, my partner, founders, we sat together and everybody said, we put our private money. And of course, everyone according to his capability, but all the founders invested in the company and some of them did it significantly. And this is the first oxygen that you need to be able to actually move. And this was a serious step. So when you have So first, you need good partners, not only for the funding, but naturally, but to support you, to give you good advice, to help you pull through. So this is the first advice. When you start such a crazy journey, find good partners. And then, yes, and we closed round B 3 months ago, almost 4 months ago. And it was in the middle of the 2023, which was few friends told me it's a startup breaker. 23 was terrible, and we did round B with oversubscription. And again, there are many great startups out there. You need a combination. Of course, you need a good idea and a good company. Doesn't go without this, especially not with the high amounts. But if you build the entire ecosystem, when you have a good company and good partners, and you find good investors that are able to see eye to eye with you, there you have the whole thing. So I don't know if everything I said can be considered as an advice, but at least this is what we did.
No, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Well, in your press releases, you mentioned the name of the system, which is Sapien. What about Sapien do you think that, and I know that you guys are in stealth. You guys will be at LSI this year, I believe, in Dana Point.
Yeah, so you said a few things. That's right. First, it's the old name. You saw it in round A, the name Sapien, and we decided to change name. Part of the full process that we did for branding is the name that we started. This I liked it from the beginning, because we'll talk in a second about why, but it's it resonates well for me with the shape of the system. We'll talk about it in a second, but now we no longer call it Sapien. Now the product name is Dynaris. We can talk about it. I don't know how much it's interesting.
You said something interesting. So the original name was Sapien, and now it's Dynamis, correct?
Yeah.
That's a nice name. And you said it's Sapien because of the shape of the system. So
yeah. We'll talk about it in a second.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And this is the second thing you said about the stealth. Yes, again, in our business, it's an IP thing, and as much as you can stay in stealth mode, at least in my opinion, it's important. And we ran for a full 3 years as much as possible in stealth mode. This is from the natural reasons to allow ourselves as much as possible the comfort to create IP and get as much as possible that you can do it. And then I would say it's good to do it. And then you also mentioned LSI in March. Yes. So basically in 2 weeks, I think pretty much in the same time you were going to broadcast this or maybe a bit after. So we will, you can say, reveal some portion of our product. And I can say a few sentences about it. We're not showing everything from the same reason that I said a minute ago. But we will, starting from a few weeks from now, we will say a few things about what we're doing. And if I can say one or two sentences, we are planning to bring to the market relatively soon the first multi-arm robotic system. Of course, multi-arm systems exist, again, in the soft tissue area, the Da Vinci, four arms, there are systems with two, three arms. And in the hard tissue area, it's one arm, always one arm, when it's an arm. And we can talk about this a lot. What does it mean? And why do we need more than one arm? So that we can talk about this. But this is the core system. It's a multi-arm system. Part of it is to handle exactly what you said at the beginning. We want to do more. So again, it's not the only thing, but how do you do more? One thing I can tell you, try to tie your shoelaces with one arm and then you will see. And spine surgery is more complicated than tie your shoelaces. And so one of the things that the market needs, we believe, is a system that can do more, a more capable system. And this is what we're doing. And I hope I answered everything you said.
Yeah. No, you definitely did. And I think that's actually a really good analogy. And you're right about, you know, tying your shoe with one arm. I think, you know, spine surgery is definitely complicated. Again, outside of pedicle screw fixation, if you look at the procedure from start to finish, there's a lot of parts of the procedure that are highly complex. And, you know, one of the most, arguably one of the most well-respected and famous spine surgeons in the world, Larry Lanke, came on the show recently. And towards the end, I mean, he was even saying, he's like, there's no reason why we can't have a robot that automates a lot of different parts of the procedure for me, because, you know, I don't want to be doing that. And that's Larry Lanke saying that. And so I'm wondering, you know, what's your take, like, at least on the automation side, like in robotic spine surgery? Like, does it have a place? And if so, if you can kind of expand on it. Again, I know let's assume that this episode is going to be released like post LSI. So by the time LSI happens, you'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. We'll release this afterwards, right? But what are your thoughts on the automation side? Because surgeons want it, but the FDA is kind of hesitant about that, of course, right?
Yeah. By the way, the FDA would not be hesitant if you would provide serious body of evidence that it's safe and efficient, then they would be okay. They're not the bad guys. You just need to show that it's good and it's safe. And let's see how we, because this is a big question. Let's try to take it top down. First, automation for itself, it's not a goal. I think you would agree. It's cool, but it's not the goal. The goal to automate stuff. And the real goal is to provide clinical value, right? If by automating the process you provide clinical value, then it's great. And also, this is one. Now, more specifically, to automate what? And like you said, spine surgery, and you know very well, it's complex procedure, has several parts, and it's, so if, let's take the example you gave, the example of the pedicle screw. Never mind the exact numbers, because it changes. If you put 24 screws or four, it varies a lot. But and if you take a 3 hours case, with six proofs. And it takes 25 minutes to put the six proofs. And you are able now, and you invest a lot, and you are able to fully automate this part. The surgeon is pressing a button and boom, boom, boom. After this and that time, six screws are in perfectly. Fully automation. One must ask, did you provide more clinical value? You took it from 25 minutes to 20 minutes. It will not be this. And you fully automate. Naturally, you need to see what you did to the capital cost, what you did to the disposable cost, what you did to this, sterilization, all these questions. But did you provide more clinical value? From the three-hour case, state three-hour case, and there are still portions. So, but you invested now, I don't know how many years and capital, et cetera. But you fully automated it. And you did it perfectly, and the FDA approved it. There is some value there, but we need to ask, did we achieve the goal? So this is from one side, and then but still doesn't mean that there's no room for adding automation, or I don't like the word automation in surgery. When we think robotics, if we take a minute to think about it, the robots were created originally for automation procedure of pick and place. And why do you do this? You do the same thing again and again and again. And you save time, you save labor, etc. Surgery is not automation. And there's, even if it's the same exact case, it will never be the same. And so the word automation is less, I think, less fit to surgery, spine surgery. But you augment the user and the staff with more capable tools to do what they do better, safer. In so either to do the same thing that they do, only safer, more predictable way, or push their practice to the next level. Today you do open TLIF, you can do it minimally invasive TLIF. You do it minimally invasive, you can do it percutaneous, meaning you do it endoscopy, you do more challenging procedure in a safer way. Anyway, because when you start pushing MIS, then maybe more radiation, maybe you take a higher risk. So you can provide a less invasive surgery in a safer way. So then this is at least how I try to look at it, less from the keyhole of the technology, how do I automate this, but what can we do? What kind of technology we can bring? So at the end of the day, bring more clinical value.
That makes a lot of sense. I think you have a very good point. I think specifically in spine surgery, which is, there's always been this trade-off of, as you do things that are going to be more beneficial to patients, say like minimally invasive surgery, the trade-off is you start doing more things that are less safe for the surgeon and the OR staff in terms of like radiation. And even if not radiation, I mean, just the ergonomics of minimally invasive surgery is, over time, I think something that people don't take into account is that even if you eliminate the radiation, the ergonomics of the procedure of MIS, ends up putting a lot of wear and tear on the body, like on the surgeon's body and staff body, right? Mm-hmm.
And we stood there for many hours with the leads, and you want to, and this is how they think. They want to provide a better clinical outcomes, right? And to do smaller cuts, less blood loss, the whole story. But now the surgery can be more intense. Either you use more radiation, as we discussed, but it's not the only thing. You see less. The surgery is more intense. It's a physical and a mental stress, but they are willing to do it as a professional. They want to improve their practice. And so if you support this, again, not only with the robotics, if you provide means or this, then by definition, you support better clinical outcomes.
No, I completely agree. Well, you know, as you see it today, you know, what does the ideal adopter look like, you know, for LEM, you know? That might be too specific. You can always pass on some of these questions, but you know, I think maybe you know what, Yossi, less on the clinical side, but more on the philosophical side of it. Like, what does that adopter look like? Because I think this is something that's not spoken about enough, which is, what is the psychology and disposition of an early adopter surgeon for a robotics company?
What? And for robotica? Ah, and I will take your question. I will twist it a little bit, okay? But, and if you will insist on me answering your question, I would do it, but just what? So not for LEM, for a robotic company. What is the ideal surgeon for me? But let's look at it this way. When I search a spine surgeon for my mother years ago, or for myself, you know, at some point everybody had back pain. And then you search for a surgeon at the end of the day, and I know a few, and at the end of the day, you will search for a surgeon that will apply. I'm thinking about this just because you asked me now. You will apply best practice for you. And from when I look at it, it's what is called the minimal invasiveness. It makes sense. It's not just to have a smaller scar. To do the minimal, the minimal intervention makes tons of sense. If you need to do this instrumentation or not, what kind of decompression you do, how invasive you need to be in order to achieve the required clinical outcome. Because if you do minimal intervention, but then you need to go to a revision after a while because it was minimal but not enough, and it's also not a good outcome, right? So this mindset of, once it's decided that intervention is required, naturally, if you go and you do a diet and physiotherapy and you finish, then it's great. But once it is understood that you need intervention, that then a surgeon, in my personal belief, if I would choose for myself, that is considering the minimal intervention, I think it's the healthy mindset. And sometimes the minimal intervention is an open surgery and instrumentation and 360-degree fusion. Sometimes this is what's required. But the mindset is, if I can do less, then it's better. I think I would subscribe to this.
Yeah, no, I
didn't answer exactly what you
meant. No, I think, no, you did, though. No, you did. You did. And I think, okay. I think this is the... I personally, Yossi, feel that there, and this is part of the reason why I started my company, which is this concept of like adopters, like where somebody sits on the adoption curve is really, really important, because you can have a great technology, you can have a lot of funding, you can have a great team. Like, we've seen companies like this, but then you can fail in the marketplace, not because your product is bad or you don't have the right management. It's merely based on the fact that you didn't do enough due diligence on who's going to be the first group of early adopters or limited market release sites who are going to adopt the baby, quote unquote, even though it's ugly, but work with you to say, hey, like, I see the vision of how this technology can elevate the standard of care, and I'm going to help your team get it to that point so that it's ready for mass market adoption. I think it's just so important early as a company to be disciplined about that.
100%, and I will even add some more. So first, of course, what you say is it's and to come and carve your you can call it the MVP, or to come and carve what is the thing that I need to bring so the first group will adopt it. It's critical, of course, but here, what we're trying to do, and like you said, I'm most of my efforts are going to collect around me a group of people that experience, knowledgeable, are and professional in this, and this is, we invest there a lot, and because we believe that even this is not enough, and this is one of the problems that start as a natural thing that startups suffer from, is that because this is your main focus, this is what you think. And how can I develop my idea and put it in the hands of the first 10 users? So they will help me grow. And this is, of course, if this is the beachhead, this is what you should do. But the thing is that it's not enough. If you really want to start, I cannot say this because I still didn't do it. So flags to put here, just at least this is the mindset that we're working very hard to achieve, that from day one, we always work under the assumption that the systems after the first 10, they are the more difficult to place. The commercial acceptance, this is the real hard part, and we went through this for many years, that you already have the 10, 20 first sites that you work, you're doing hundreds and thousands of surgeries with good results. But, and you know this very well, so many books were written about this, about the chasm. You were there, you had FDA, you installed the first system, then you work on a daily basis, but you're not exploding. And this is the real hard part. And there, by the way, so many companies are having struggles to cross the chasm, to have wide adoption, because the early adopters are early adopters. They have the vision. They will see beyond your ugly baby, because they have the vision and they will work with you through the difficulties. But to cross this, again, it's worth cross the chasm and to go to the normal user to have wide adoption. This is the real tough one. So we try the best we can from day one, to craft whatever we do here, also to fit for the wide adoption and not only for the early adapters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Looking in terms of this year, what are, at least from what you can share, like what are some of the key, you know, key goals that like you guys have as a team in LEM? And I guess when, actually the real question I want to ask is, when are we going to be able to see more of the system publicly?
In a few weeks, we will have our new website, because we kept it for 3 years deliberately as a landing page without, sometime I spoke with people and they told me, I went to your website, but there's nothing there. And then I always had the same answer, that it's not a bug, it's a feature. It's like this. But in a few weeks, we'll have our new website. And there, we will show part of the system, which is what I told you about the fact that we have several arms. And we can talk about a little bit why do you need several arms and what are the problems that we're trying to solve. But so in a few weeks, we will show a portion of what we do.
And again, you don't have to comment, but I'll share my thoughts, and feel free to comment on this. One of the issues I feel with all robotic systems, but especially a lot of the ones we see in spine, is they're not 100% attached to the table. And I think the issue there is that when you're not fully attached to the table, right? You know, surgery is a very physical thing, and so patient moves even a little bit, like you're off. And so, and this is why I think registration for a lot of robotic systems is so difficult, et cetera. And I think so much of it can just be solved if you have like better fixation to the table, right? That's like one of the main things that I feel. I see that you're smiling, so feel free to take that any direction that you want.
I would try not to be too specific or too technical, not to bore your...
Oh, no, the audience loves that kind of stuff, please. Yeah. Dive into it.
Let's see. You said a few things because you're in what you said, how many assumptions there are. And you talk about attaching to the table because that's what you know, right? From Zork. And it's one way to do it. There are more ways to do it, more ways to do it without attaching to the table, for example. But the issue that you described is 100% correct. The patient moves. And it can happen sometimes that people would take a sobo and do some tests. Today, with a university student, I can buy... Today, by the way, you can buy from a robotic company a full robot with attached to a navigation system and a cart, even a cart you can get from them. So with a few months, a university student, you can make a proof of concept that, and you take a sobo and here, I'm accurate. It's not enough. One of the things is exactly what you said, the patient moving, everything moves. And now I open small window. If you ask what's so difficult about spine, you can take a robotic system, and there are several that were and would try not to go to names that were extremely successful with brain surgery, knee, extremely accurate. But in spine, it doesn't work that bad. That's great, and that is you have to ask why. And spine surgeons are great. Why? What's the difference? And without going too much into details, but let's think about it for a second. The brain surgery, which of course has its brain surgery, but from robotic per se, when we look at it, it's one big box of bone in a mainframe frame. You put a tracker and you track it. You hold it firmly and you track it. And hip and knee, two big rigid bones. You put a tracker and you track them. You hold them firmly and you track them. Spine depends again, but we can have up to 30 individual fragile vertebrae that moves all over. How do you track this? And think about it for a second, all the companies that you know, at the end of the day, you have one marker there. But you have multiple elements that move. Just by placing a cage, by definition, you move the vertebrae one from each other. But you track this guy, so what about this guy? Let alone if you put your tracker on the iliac crest and you operate there. So the challenge here from robotic perspective is significant. It's very different. And you have to solve this. If not, you will stagnate in the same place that companies are struggling. And this is one of the things that you have to solve. There are a few, if I need to summarize everything I said until now really fast. And one is that spine surgery is very diverse. You have orthopedics and neurosurgery. With instrumentation, without instrumentation. How many types of decompressions you know? There's no one type of decompression, not one type of fusion, not one type of fixation. It's so diverse. And sometimes it's so diverse that it requires completely different robotic morphology to handle it. And it's very diverse. So you need a very capable system to handle this diversity. You cannot tell a surgeon that that's just bought a system with a hefty price. This I cover. When you do your lumbar cases, I cover. But when you do your whatever his practice is, when you do endoscopy, cervical, there, I mean, at the limit. It's a problem. And so you need to be able to handle the large variety of cases. The second thing is the relative motion that we discussed that is relatively unique to spine. It moves and you cannot just put a forest of markers. I still need to work there. So at least here in LEM, we understood that besides the need to cover the large variety of cases, we had to deal also with the navigation. It cannot stay as it is. And one stationary camera that observes everything, and everything needs to serve the camera 6 feet from the patient, and then it drives so many requirements, because the camera is stationary and observing, and what is called the line of sight, which is a big deal. It's a thing that everybody learned to work around it, but it has so many implications and limitations that it had to be solved. And we're working, and of course, we believe we solved it well. So really, generally speaking, these are the things that you have to deal with that are relatively unique to spine, that you have to deal with if you don't want to stagnate in the same place and move forward, and then be able to support more diverse and complicated portions of the spine.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, Yossi, I appreciate you coming on the show, but, you know, real quick, aside, you know, you guys are going to be at LSI USA and Dana Point. But other than that, any other conferences, whether it's Investor Summit or spine conferences you guys are going to be at this year that, you know, surgeons or investors can find you at?
And a few things. One, we're not doing any fundraising now, but we are reaching out to know people, important players. Naturally, it's part of what we do and what we are. You said we'll be there with another individual that you know, Chris Prantix. I know him from back then, many years. He's our chief commercial officer, and we have a U.S. team now, a commercial team, together to him and the team. We are starting what we discussed about, not only thinking about the beachhead, but also the market adoptions. Chris and the team now are working towards this, towards commercialization. Chris and I will be in LSI, and again, it's not for fundraising, but it's to start establishing relationship with important any players in the field. And this is basically what we will do there in March. We're not presenting, we're not talking, we're coming to May to listen, to meet people, important people. And then throughout 24, we're not presenting in exhibitions. We are more focused in doing the job.
Will you be attending any conferences like NAS or ESMIS or ISAS or anything? Not exhibiting, but attending.
Yeah, we will have a representation.
Okay, got it. Perfect. Well, Yossi, look, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I'm really excited to see what LEM's up to, just because, for me, I went to NAS recently, and, I saw some interesting companies, but nothing that really got me excited. So I'm excited to see more from the company. And the listeners who are listening, be sure to check out LEM. Just go to lemsurgical.com. That's lemsurgical.com to learn more. I'm your host, Omar Khatib, and this has been another episode of The State of MedTech. We'll see you all next time.
Thank you for enjoying another epic episode of The State of MedTech. If you're feeling inspired and love this episode, do us a favor, hit that subscribe button and turn notifications on so you never miss an episode. And be sure to give us 5 stars and write a short review, because that helps more people discover this amazing community of ours. If you're a company who has a executive that you'd like to be on the show, or perhaps you want to sponsor one of the episodes, shoot us an email at hello@khatibandco.com. Take care, see you next time.